the point of the reading this week is to think about the ways in which education is related to dominant ideology. And if you wanted to get real specific, how is education related to the dominance of ideas like success and other American values? How are dominant values, dominant attitudes, personal tendencies, belief structures, habit forms, how are they related to education? And once you start thinking about that stuff, then you also need to be thinking critically about the format that we are already engaged in here. So we're looking specifically at the texts, Women and the Subversion of the Community, written by Selma James and Maria Rosa Dalla Costa, and then Bell Hooks' essay, Confronting Class in the Classroom, and the short piece by Joan Stembridge talking about Stokely Carmichael's class on language. There's a lot of stuff about women and the position of women in the Women and the Subversion of the Community text. And I'll talk some about that. But the primary reason that I put that in, at least at this point in our class, is to think about the role that the school plays in an overall capitalist system. So let's start there. There's two focuses in the Selma James and Dalla Costa text. The two focuses are women and schools. These women, they're writing, coming out of a movement called Wages for Housework, which is an international feminist movement sort of in the 1970s and 1980s, and that's coming out of a movement within Italy in the 1970s called Autonomia. What this movement tried to do was to advance the typical pattern for labor struggle, to change that in ways that would recognize the role and the place of women and children within overall class struggle, I suppose. What they want to say is, so historically, dominant oppositional views towards capitalism have suggested that the way to fight capitalism is through the factory. Because in the factory, the laborers are in a position where they work in order to produce so that they can bring home a wage, so that they can live and their family can live. But ultimately, a portion of the value that they produce while in the factory, and this is the whole point of capitalist production, this is a very quick summary of the Marxist view, and I've given you a diagram that you can check out about this. A portion of the value, the maximum portion of the value, of what they produce while they're in the factory does not go back to them. It goes into the pocket of the capitalist. That's capital. That's profit. Profit is the difference between what people are capable of producing and what is actually given back to them in terms of value. Some car is made, it's sold on the open market. A portion of the returns go to pay the wages of the people, but only ever a portion. And no businessman would continue, no corporation would continue producing if what they had to pay to the workers always equaled exactly what they got back, because then there would be no profit. And what would be the point of capitalist endeavor with no capital? The point of this process is to produce profit. Capital will be defined as ever accumulating profit that is reintroduced into processes of production, circulation, and capital valorization, meaning the return of a profit over and over and over. So capital is a growing body of value that is deployed to produce more and more value. At whose expense? At the expense of the workers. How much money do they get? They are a commodity like everything else. We are a commodity like anything else under capitalism. And our rate is determined by laws like supply and demand, and a little bit by past struggles through unions and so on, which is one reason that we cost more in the United States than folks in the rest of the world do, because we had this history of unions. But of course, our real wage hasn't gone up for 30, 40 years under neoliberalism. That is, the amount of money we get compared to what it costs to live has not gone up. We've been kept at this static state. So the traditional sort of union labor-oriented and even the radical left ideas about how to fight capitalism is that you do it through production. Specifically, you do it through unionization and strikes. The power of the strike is the fundamental power that workers have, because it's only by means of their labor that profit and hence capital is accumulated. So we also have the power to withdraw our labor from that process, to grind capital valorization to a halt, and therefore to allow the competitor of a capitalist to drive that capitalist out of business, this is a way of putting pressure upon the capitalist to change the conditions of work in our behalf, right? This is the traditional idea about how you fight capital. You do it in the factory. So the view of these women is that, well, that leaves some really serious, important stuff out. If you think that struggle, class struggle, only happens at the workplace, you're missing the whole life of women as housewives and as child raisers, and also the plight and the situation of children within a capitalist economy. Okay, so in order to tell this story, then they go back and they tell an historical story about what happens as capitalism is imposed. There are a bunch of different versions of this story that I've been really interested in. Another person who writes along these lines is named Sylvia Federici, and she gives this story in much greater detail. In her work, we could talk about processes happening both in the New World, in Latin America, and in North America, and especially in North America, we're going to look at this process happening. It happens later in North America than it does in Europe, but in this case, we're looking primarily at Europe. There was a point when Europe was not capitalist. It was feudal, and under the feudal system, of course, enserfed peasants were exploited by aristocrats, but they were exploited in a, you know, in a different way than capitalism exploited them. And their family structure was different, and hence their social relationships were different. And the relationships between men and women were different. The division of labor between men and women was different. And the relationship between children and their family was different. The family was bigger, by which I mean that there tended to be extended kinship networks, and there was no such thing as the nuclear family. Nuclear family means a unit of social organization consisting of a man, a woman, and their children, conceived as existing in some kind of, you know, like in a house, in a closed space. That idea, which a whole lot of people coming out of the history, once it gets established, consider to be natural and how it's always been, is not how it's always been. The women have not always been stuck into the house. The women have not always been in a position where their labor was considered to matter less than the labor of men. It was not always the case that, you know, real work was defined as work that got a wage, whereas other work, or women's work, was defined by the fact that it didn't get a wage. That didn't used to be the case. It didn't used to be the case that children were taken away from their parents at the age of 4 or 5 and kept in institutional confines where they were systematically fed certain ideas and systematically caused to behave in super disciplined ways. That didn't exist before capitalism. So they'll say capitalism is the first system to systematically pull the entire population at a young age into an institutional context where they are formed. Okay, so it's the situation of women in the home and of children in the schools that comes under scrutiny. You know, the idea is that struggle has to happen there too. If you want to fight against this system, it can't just be done in the factory, because the women and the household are indispensable to this system too, and therefore what happens in the household is crucial for the perpetuation or transformation of the system. And the same thing can be said about kids in school. That kids being in the school is a part of the functioning of the system. If they're not kept in the school, you're not going to produce the next generation of workers, of submissive workers, and therefore the system will grind to a halt. So the general term for the labor that is done in both these places can be called reproductive labor, meaning the labor that reproduces the system. The home and the woman in the home reproduces the laborer by feeding him, by taking care of his clothes, by making him feel better, by having sex with him. All these different things that tend to the worker and make it possible for the worker to show up at work again the next day and do the job again. This is reproductive labor. Even the supply of laborers at all comes about through childbirth. So women are feeding the system at home. They are placed into a subjugated role in the home, and they think that this is a, if it's not like a calculated process, it's a process which is integral to this overall system. It can't do without it. So they're in a subjugated position in the household because they are prevented, or historically were prevented, from going to work and getting a wage. And by the way, the idea is not here that, like, you know, women should be able to go to work and get the wage, because the whole idea is getting a wage is getting exploited too. But women are in a doubly precarious situation because they are at the whim of their husbands, and the women and the husbands are in a structural position of power because they are the ones who are bringing home the wage, and the women perform this reproductive function, and their labor is therefore controlled by the capitalist too. It's just they don't get paid for it. Okay, and then the school, there's struggle that happens in the school, and there should be struggle that happens in the school, because the way that they conceive the role of the school is that the school is there in order to reproduce the workforce. And that means that school has to change. We'll see this in more detail when we get to Althusser later in the semester. But the school has to change and its programs have to change as the division of labor changes, as technology changes, as the different sorts of jobs that capitalists need people to do, as those change, the schools have to change too. So the fundamental role of the schools is to produce skilled labor that will be the next generation that makes production and behavior and life happen as it has been happening within this capitalist system. But on the other hand, it's also necessary in these contexts to produce submission, to not only have a body of people who will be able to do the jobs that are required of them, but also to have a body of people who are willing to do the jobs that are required of them. That's what the schools are. And so we get this presentation of the schools as systems of authoritarian control. And then we need to start focusing on how does a classroom work? How does a school work? What is the relationship of students to teachers, typically speaking? And I think the answer to that is that, well, the teachers are in charge. The children are supposed to shut up. Even in a college classroom, the professor is in charge and the students are supposed to shut up. Generally speaking, there is a relationship of domination and there is a one-way flow of information and instruction. All of the things that people have to do in order to make it through school are also things that they will have to do in order to be able to be good workers. So we have to see the school as an aspect of control. And if our class in particular is about the distribution of ideology, but also more broadly about the production of certain psychological attitudes and certain habits of the body, certain habits about submission as opposed to revolt, then you probably can't find a place in our society that is more intrinsic to the power of a dominant class and the power of this dominant system than the schools. Okay, so you can read to get further details on this. I'll just put in something quick about the Hooks and Stembridge because I think that stuff is pretty easy to read. I'll just point out that they ask you to ask yourself questions about what goes on in classrooms and what is taught, and especially what is supposed to be the kind of conduct within a classroom. How are you supposed to act? How are you supposed to talk? How are you supposed to not talk? Aren't you supposed to be quiet for the most part? Aren't you supposed to abstain from loud expressions? You're not supposed to talk in the way that people on the streets talk, because now we're in school and that's official, right? It's like a workplace. Only certain types of speaking are accepted. But generally speaking, in a classroom, we don't talk about these things. Rather, we impose them together with a kind of regime of silence that says anybody who speaks anyway except for these basically middle class, you might also say basically white, standards of behavior, anyone who speaks in any other way is simply going to be belittled, shamed, and in the extreme case, pushed out of the room. You're not supposed to get passionate. You're not supposed to talk the way you talk with your friends or with your family. Now, if you look at that, the Stembridge text talking about Stokely Carmichael's class, then the question there is, how come? And how come you're supposed to talk correct English, which really means some particular class's vision of what correct English is? Why? Would you be stupider? Are you stupider when you speak informally with your friends and family than when you speak formally at work or in a classroom? That doesn't seem likely, does it? I mean, would your intelligence be varying as your word choice changed? No. You're exactly as smart in both places. And probably, you know, where are you more honest? Well, perhaps with your friends and your family. So why is it then that everybody submits to certain models of decorum, certain ways of acting, certain ways of speaking, which are generally speaking middle class and bourgeois models of behavior? Now, why, in order to succeed in America, do people of color have to talk like white people? Why, in order to succeed in America, do people from the working classes and the lower classes have to adopt the mannerisms, the style of dress, even the cultural preferences of the middle and upper classes? Isn't this sort of a part of colonization? Doesn't this mean that communities which have a certain richness to them, a certain integrity, a certain way of dealing with one another, are broken by the educational system? Doesn't education, and here we are back to James and Dalla Costa, doesn't education actually break up and compromise and weaken and shame the working class? Doesn't it split them into parts? Doesn't the grading system separate portions of the working class from one another so that we have good students and bad students, A students and F students, A students and B students, honor students and the other students? Isn't the function of the educational system systematically to attack the working class, break its solidarity, reduce its capacity to push against the system on the whole, and to pull individuals away from one another and into relationships of dependence where their activity is going to serve the interests of those who employ them and those who dominate them, but not one another? This is the overall set of questions, right? And there are some inverse sort of suggestions there, which are like, and if the working class wanted to affirm itself, wanted to legitimize itself, and especially wanted to retain its integrity and its social solidarity, its lateral connections between members, wouldn't it also have to resist the practices of the school? Wouldn't it have to resist turning into the middle class, resist adopting the cultural preferences of the middle and upper classes? Refined people are supposed to listen to Mozart. Why? Why can't you listen to Nas? Why can't you listen to James Brown? Why is culture white culture and bourgeois culture? So a project of empowering the working class and to some extent empowering people of color, because class and race here are integrated or overlapping in very complicated ways, a project to reestablish the power of those groups of people, wouldn't that also have to be a project of affirming the way that people talk outside of the classroom, the way that people talk outside of work, the cultural preferences and the style preferences and the manner of comportment and the manner of expression and the manner of interaction that is true outside the classroom and outside the workplace? Wouldn't we have to affirm those too? So these are all kinds of questions for you to think about. And I would ask you to start thinking about how they apply to our class, to your classes, in your experience. Is this going on? What should be